Hi, I'm Ali Hassan, host of CBC's Laugh Out Loud. Do you like to laugh? Because we're serving up big laughs each week. We feature comedians from across Canada. You might already be fans of some of them, and others might be new discoveries. We record emerging comedians and established pros in front of live audiences all across the country, and we promise that you'll be literally laughing out loud. You can find Laugh Out Loud on the CBC Listen app or wherever you get your podcasts.
This is a CBC podcast.
I'm AC Rowe, sitting in for Tom Power. You're listening to Q. She's described it as some of the saddest music she's ever written, but I just hear beauty. That's Montreal's Alexandra Strelitzky with The First Kiss from her album Neo-Romance. Alexandra's music is introspective, cinematic, romantic, and it resonates with people all over the world. But her path has not been straightforward. Alexandra worked in an ad agency for years until the late, great Canadian filmmaker Jean-Marc Vallée heard her music and started using it in films like The Dallas Buyers Club and shows like Sharp Objects and Big Little Lies. This gave Alexandra exactly the push she needed to do music full-time. And now, she is up for Album of the Year at the Junos. Alexandra Strelitzky stopped by the Q studio to talk with Tom Power about her latest album, moving to Europe, and her friendship with Jean-Marc Vallée.
How are you?
Hello, Tom. So happy to be here.
Nice to see you. How you doing?
I'm great. I just flew in from Amsterdam, so I'm a little, you know, jet-lagged, but kind of getting used to it.
Is that where you were when you found out you got nominated for the Album of the Year, Juno? Where were you?
Where was I? Good question.
What a
life. I was around. I don't know.
What a life.
Yeah, I do. I am traveling quite a lot.
Is it an email? Is it a phone call? Do you remember?
What happened? Oh, Nick, yeah, from Secret City texted me. He was like, oh my God. And I'm like, what was happening? I didn't even know it was the Juno's nomination. And he was stoked. And I mean, I get excited for myself, but I get so excited for my team in these moments because they work so hard to put the music out there and spread the love. And that's like a big, big, you know, sign of recognition also for them. So
it's exciting to see. Yeah. I hope you don't mind me saying this. It's exciting to see an instrumental classical piano record.
Totally.
Nominated for the big Album of the Year prize. You don't see it every day.
You don't, certainly not. It happened on Inscape, my previous album too. We were at the press conference and I remember just being like, my jaw fell. I was nominated for Breakthrough Artist, Album of the Year and Instrumental Album. And the fact that the instrumental music just crosses those barriers is lovely.
I love that you called the album Neo-Romance because, so you get called neoclassical all the time.
Yeah. We all do.
That's a weird term.
It's not the right term, yeah.
Okay, well, why isn't it the right term?
Well, I mean, first, neoclassical already existed. Mm-hmm. It's a movement, and when I read about it, I'm like, this has nothing to do with anything that resonates in what I do as an artist.
For people who don't know, the classical era of music, like the Baroque era and the Romantic era, there was a classical era that's where the term classical music largely comes from. Mm-hmm. And then there was also a neoclassical movement.
Yes, yes, which was back to structure, back to something more rational. And then, the Romantics were all about emotion, about imagination, about expressing individuality in the big world. And I identify much more to this movement. And the point is really not to, let's have a history of art discussion over this album. I don't really care. I never cared where you put my music. Is it pop, classical? I don't care about that. What I do like is the notion of romanticism and what it means in today's world to be a romantic.
What does it mean in today's world
to be
a romantic?
What does it mean to be, you know, a dreamer? Can you dream, you know? I think it's hard. I think it's tough to remain optimistic and to remain open to dreaming because our world is quite cynical and quite polarized. And I thought that was an interesting thing. And I think music has a big, big power to bring people back in their hearts and to fight a little bit this cynicism through emotion and through beauty.
Thank you. were in Europe during the pandemic when you started working on this record, is that right?
Yeah.
What were you going through when you started composing the music on this record?
I was actually, so I was in Rotterdam, mm-hmm. and I was on the traces of my ancestors on my dad's side, because I realized they were all musicians on his side. And I thought I was the only musician in my family.
Were they piano players?
They were mostly conductors and violinists and Jewish origin. And the women played, the men played, and it was extremely common amongst those, like four generations back.
Right.
And they were Dutch. And I didn't really know that. So I kind of went on their trace, and it inspired me a lot to write. And I was in a new love also, so neo-romance also because of that. Also because I liked the idea of exploring this... this vulnerability you have when you fall in love again, especially when you're getting older and you've suffered a breakup before,
yeah.
and you know, oh no, okay, I'm going to fall in love again. This comes with potentially grief, loss, and a lot. You have to risk it, you know?
Yeah, you've already been through something really
hard.
You've
already been through it.
And you have to go, am I willing to do this again with somebody else?
Yeah.
Why were you interested in looking, you found out that these relatives of yours were musicians.
Mm-hmm.
And you said you wanted to trace their path. Why?
But just because I thought it was really random that I fell in love and moved to the Netherlands. And turns out I had a bunch of relatives that lived there that were also musicians.
You didn't know?
No.
Wow.
No. Yeah.
How did you find out?
We knew we had some Dutch relatives, but not really to what extent and what they did. And I went further into it. And some of them unfortunately died in Auschwitz. And I actually met with their immediate descendant the other day.
What did you talk about?
We talked about that, unfortunately, about how they lived. The war is because in Jewish families, you have these big breaks. Just our grandparents just didn't want to talk about anything.
Of course.
They didn't want to talk about being Jewish.
Of course.
And you just hide. And so lots of families were sparse. And it's quite beautiful, actually, because we met through music, because one of them found my Spotify.
They found your music.
Yeah, I got a random email from a man called Jur Strelitsky, and he said, we may be related. And I was literally on the traces of his immediate family.
While making the record that he was listening to there.
Yeah.
What an interesting internal exploration time this was for you, to both to look into your family and to sort of explore, like, hey, I'm in love with somebody else.
Yeah.
Am I capable of this? Is this something that I really want to do? A lot going on.
Yeah, a lot going on. I mean, it's fertile grounds for music and for creativity.
I guess my question is about how generative this music is from you, because I don't really understand your compositions. I love them and they're beautiful. Can you take me through the composition process? I'm looking down the path of my ancestors. I'm falling in love and I'm not sure if I want to, or I'm falling in love and I can't help it. And then you sit down at the piano and just like Keith Jarrett or something like that, just see what comes out.
Well, I don't know if Keith Jarrett comes out, but...
No, but you know how he did those concerts where he would walk up on stage and just completely improvise.
But that's... I don't think that I would permit myself to be as free as that yet. I would love to reach that, but that's exactly what happens. I just sit at the piano and something comes out.
When you say you sit down at the piano and something comes out, are you sitting down at the piano thinking, my family in the Netherlands?
No, not at all. I'm interested in my family in the Netherlands on the side as a person. And I'm in love. And this is what I'm living. And it just, the music, you know, then I tie it back to the story. But ultimately, the music just comes out. And it's not at all a cerebral process for me.
Do you remember the first time you sat down at the piano and something just kind of rolled out of you?
Yeah, like it was an improv. I remember I recorded it. It was called Atmosphere. I was, I think, 12 or 11, and it had like big basses and high ambitus, you know, and really, really high notes, kind of this creepy mood. And that was the first time that I can remember kind of improvising and creating some cinematic mood.
Did you have any sense that it was any good, or this was something that you liked doing?
I knew I'd love to do that, yeah. And then, like, for instance, I started to compose some themes, and I had that going on and led me to, eventually I worked in advertisement. And I was composing a lot. I was doing a bunch of different projects.
What kind of stuff? Like jingles or like...
Yeah, I would get more commission to do like Via Rai or Air Canada, like this deep, like this emotional...
The Air Canada hold music, that kind of thing. Or like the, you know, when they do the buckle in your seatbelt, the...
No, more like we bring you to places and like good, you know, inspirational ads. That's what I was good at.
The vibe I'm getting is that you had this sort of other secret life where you were composing for yourself.
Yeah. So what happened is that I got very tired of composing for, I'm not going to say meaningless, but a little bit. I had a strong artistic voice that was just boiling in me. So if you just put that aside and you keep doing commission, you're going to get it. Eventually, it's going to come and bite you in the, you know.
Yeah, I get you.
So that's a little bit what happened to me. I had a huge burnout.
You had a burnout at work?
I had a burnout at work, yeah.
And you said, I can't really do this anymore.
Yeah. So actually, I had two moments. Once I released Pianoscope, which was in 2010, which was also like, I'm getting sick of writing for ads.
Yeah, I'm going to put something out.
And Pianoscope. And then that got noticed by Jean-Marc.
Tell me that story. So yeah. Okay. So
I put out this record because I was moving out of my parents' house and I thought, I want to work for films. And I'm like, okay, well, I'm going to put out a record that just feels very... very, very true to who I am, and what I love to do, what I do best, and here it is. And so I put out these themes that I had. Some of them were quite old. I developed them, and then I just had a band camp. My mom was sending some albums to people, and eventually it just started to go. Like, she started sending albums to China, and I had just a small clip I did with a friend in my country house, and that just starting to get views and views and views, and eventually led to Jean-Marc Vallée.
Jean-Marc Vallée, for people who don't know, I mean, the late Jean-Marc Vallée, one of the most important Quebecois filmmakers of all time, one of the most important Canadian filmmakers of all time. You might have seen stuff like Big Little Lies or Sharp Objects or The Dallas
Buyers Club. Or Crazy, which is a great movie.
I saw Crazy when I was like 17.
Crazy is a really good movie. I mean, all of his movies are really good.
Okay, so he calls you or?
I got an email. So I started to get a lot of demands, and then I got a publisher, which was my first partner ever. I was like, I need help, just because people were like, can I put your song in this? Can I put your... And I started working with someone, and then so the Jean-Marc's ask came through him, which was great. And it was for Dallas Buyers Club. Great movie as well.
Yeah.
Yeah.
What goes through your mind when that happens?
Well, I was a big fan of his already. So I was like, really? Like, I don't know, it was incredible. And I remember going to the movies, seeing Dallas Buyers Club, and he put Prelude is the name of this track, and he put it in the end of the movie, like in a big reveal, very emotional. And I was, it was incredible for me to see my, I dreamt since I was a little girl to do film music. So it was a big moment. Plus, I respected so much, Jean-Marc still do, as an artist. So it was, it meant, maybe I can do this. Maybe my work has enough quality to, and that's what you seek, you know. Eventually you seek to just work with artists that you respect, and I think that's the goal, you know, to collaborate and to create things. So it was, it was super, I was with my partner, and I remember just being, it's a surreal moment to see Matthew McConaughey and my music in the background.
I mean, I got one life, right? Mine. But I want somebody else sometimes. Sometimes I just feel like I'm fighting for life. I just ain't got time to live. I want it to mean something.
It does.
And then he won an Oscar, and the music was played live, which was also like... extremely
like
surprising.
The Oscar band was playing your music?
Yes, and I was watching TV wanting the movie to do good.
Yeah.
And I was like, wait a minute, there's no flute on my track? And started to get a lot of emails of people who recognized the song, and it was a beautiful moment.
And the Oscar goes to Matthew McConaughey.
And then you quit the job?
No. Took me... more 5 years to quit the job.
5 years Six. After you were in...
It's not the same job exactly, but I went back to ads. I was raising a little boy also with my ex, so I felt kind of, okay, I'm going to get a salary and do something stable. And then I had the burnout, which led me to Inkscape.
Think of your favorite one-hit wonder.
Or that overpriced toy your parents would never let you have.
Or that TV show that no one else remembers because it was canceled way too soon. Now what if we could fix it? I'm Francesca Ramsey.
And I'm DeLon Grant. And after 20 years of friendship, we are now hosting a new nostalgia podcast called Let Me Fix It.
Each episode, we'll dig into our favorite celebrities, shows, and brands of yesteryear, and then imagine what it would take to repackage them for relevance today.
Think of our show as an intervention, but with way less stakes.
So subscribe to Let Me Fix It wherever you get your favorite podcasts.
What does the burnout feel like? Can I ask that?
What does burnout feel like?
What is that? What does that? I know what burnout feels like.
You know? Yeah.
What does that burnout feel like? What did it feel like?
Well, it just felt like I was in front of my computer and nothing would come out. There's nothing. I was just, yeah. You have a symptom usually that starts. Mine was migraines in the back of the head. And you just want to cry all the time and you have no energy. And I, thing is, I quit my job and I had to stay for 6 more months. And that just... That killed me.
What was transformational about that? You got burnout.
Oh, everything. I mean, because I knew my burnout was because I was not expressing my voice. I was not on my path.
Yeah.
I think often that's what it is, mixed with, you know, maybe you're a perfectionist, you're ambitious, and you have bad management.
Yeah.
Like a bunch of these things.
Yeah.
That correlate. You can't have just, it's never like you're overworking. It's not just because you're overworking.
Yeah.
It has to be like this deep thing. And so I knew I was out of my track. And I knew exactly what my track was. I was just petrified to go on stage and to live this life that I'm living now. So it was extremely transformative, to answer your question, because it led me where I am here.
I mean, then when Inscape comes out, it charts in 20 countries, over 300 million streams. It won you a Juno.
Yeah.
How did that really feel?
It was a marathon because it went out. People responded to the record so loudly. And I it was from start to finish just an enormous ascension, and lots of people, lots of concerts. I started out, I was like, guys, I don't really want to play. I don't like to play. I was ready to, you know, puke before every concert because I'm nervous, and I was ready to do that. I was like,
right, because all this stuff was composed in your home and performed in a studio or something like that, or in your home. You weren't used to getting on stage and performing.
No, and I was a little afraid. It's because I knew, because Pianoscope had reached certain heights and was resonating. I was afraid that it would resonate, because since I'm a kid, when I play the piano, people stop. And they listen, and then old ladies start to cry, and I was afraid of that. I was afraid of being, because sometimes, especially when you're a kid, you don't want people to stop and to cry, you know. And I was afraid of what that was going to bring, this emotional intensity in my life. And I mean, it's still difficult. It's a
what is the people have to.
It's very emotional. My music is very emotional and brings a lot of
it does.
Of tears and just and what we were saying in the beginning of these very deep human connections, and it's tiring. It's, as a person, I have to dedicate myself every night and bring myself back to these places, and it can get daunting. So I was very afraid of that. I was afraid that it would work. And but I didn't have. I wanted to. When I released Inscape, I was ready to do it.
You've used words like "I was afraid" a couple of times, and you talked to me about burnout a couple of times. When you are playing piano, how do you not doubt it? Like, how do you not exercise self-doubt? Like, oh, is that?
I mean, you do. I think all artists doubt themselves. I think. Most artists that I truly respect deeply have some kind of imposter syndrome. I think it's totally normal to doubt. I think it's sometimes it's just evil. Sometimes it's just a voice that you have to just, hey, sit down, let me do my thing. You have to just, you have to keep in your heart close to why you do music in the first place. And that voice, you have to erase everything else and just go back to this all the time. And music has this beautiful power of expressing things you couldn't with anything else and can plug directly into emotion. And that's what I love.
I mean, if that's not an album that's nominated for Album of the Year, I don't know what is. If that's not the explanation of an album that's nominated for
well,
Album
it's
of the
a
Year.
Great honor, honestly.
It's beautiful music.
Thank you.
And it's so nice to see it be. There's a version of this that sounds patronizing, and I don't mean it to be. I hope you know that. But just like, there's a world in which this music doesn't get appreciated the way that it is.
Yeah,
and
of
I'm
course.
So happy that it's being appreciated the way that it is.
Well, I mean, it will be appreciated by whoever wants to appreciate it, really. Yeah. That's.
But it's just so beautiful, man. It's so lovely and powerful, and I really do love it. And I'll stop making you feel uncomfortable. And
I'm okay. I'll just sip my tea.
Have some more tea. Thank you so much for coming in. I really appreciate
thank
it.
Thank you, Tom.
Love talking to you.
Was Alexandra Strelisky with Borders from her new album, Neo Romance. It's out everywhere now. Before that, you heard her sipping tea and chatting with Tom Power. Alexandra Strelisky's record, Neo Romance, is up for Album of the Year at the Junos. She'll also be performing. The Junos are happening in Halifax this Sunday. As I mentioned, cbcmusic.ca/Junos for more. That's it for this week. Q is produced by Ben Edwards, Vanessa Greco, Lise Hossein, Nikki Manfredi, Vanessa Nigro, Cora Najawan, Mitch Pollack, and Catherine Stockhausen. Our digital team is Eva Chu, Shuli Grossman-Gray, March Mercanti, and Mackenzie Ribello. Our podcast producer is Caitlin Swan. Our director is Matthew Murphy. Our engineer is Gabby Hagel-Riles. Our senior producer is Beza Seifa. Anne McKeegan is our executive producer. I'm AC Rowe, sitting in for Tom Power. Thanks for listening.
For more CBC podcasts, go to cbc.ca/podcasts.